from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, in case anything really major has happened in Egypt in the last 2 or 3 hours, it will not be reflected on this broadcast because this broadcast is being pre-recorded a few hours before you hear it, because I am either on my way to, at, or just having been at the Cinema on the Bayou Film Festival in Lafayette, Louisiana, showing The Big Uneasy back on its march across America. But, of course, this is January, so that's a little premature. But nonetheless, that's where I'm at right now as you hear this, is what I'm saying. But apropos of that film, a story I have not told before about that motion picture, that documentary, which, for those of you who haven't seen it or heard about it, details the investigations into the cause of the 2005 flooding of New Orleans. Hint, not a natural disaster. Anyway, we were scouting before shooting, and the cinematographer, the producer, and I were scouting the exterior of the offices of the United States Army Corps of Engineers, because some of the people who were involved in that disaster work in that building. We were going to interview them. We wanted to see what the outside of the building looked like. We were going to photograph it. Put a photograph of it in the film, you see. And as we're standing on a public street corner across a public street from this public building, our producer came back across the street and said, well, the guard in the guard shack just said you guys have to stop. Well, what do you mean? You can't photograph this building. We were taking like cell phone photos or Polaroids just to see how it looked at different angles and stuff. No, you can't do that. You can't photograph this building. I now read from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security Federal Protective Service Threat Management Division. It is important that law enforcement uphold the public's general right to photograph the exterior of federal structures while being vigilant with respect to suspicious indicators of terrorist or criminal activity. According to the Federal Protective Service, they're emphasizing, quote, the public's right to photograph the exterior of federal facilities from publicly accessible spaces such as streets, sidewalks, parks, and plazas. Officers should not seize the camera or its contents and must be cautious not to give such orders to a photographer to erase the contents of a camera. So there, on another subject, one that might be even more apropos this weekend. Who's this guy, Suleiman? Omar Suleiman, who's just been named vice president. By the way, Egypt, country that got along without a vice president for 30 years, and now suddenly they've got one. Anyway, It speaks to the role of vice presidencies generally. I mean, John Nance Garner famously said in the United States, he was one of FDR's vice presidents, the vice presidency isn't worth, in his slightly Baudelaireized phrase, a warm bucket of spit. But to actually do without the office for 30 years and then suddenly discover when things get hot, you know what we need around here is a good vice president. It's just like the decision-making that went into the NBC-Comcast merger. You know the problem with NBC? It just isn't big enough. Then people would watch. But anyway, who is Omar Suleiman, the new vice president of Egypt? Described by Jane Mayer, author of The Dark Side, who was on this broadcast a couple years ago being interviewed about that book, as Egypt's most powerful spy and secret policeman. Well, that'll respond to the crowd's desire for more transparency, won't it? And democracy. Did our work, according to Jane Mayer's book, The Dark Side, the sort of work Western countries have no appetite to do themselves. That is to say, when we had detainees or other bad guys, evildoers, that we wanted to interrogate in a roughhouse kind of fashion, we shipped him over to Egypt, and Omar Suleiman took care of things from there. It was a spy agency that had the closest links with America and the CIA. And according to, actually, those first quotes were from a book called The Ghost Plane. But this is from The Dark Side by Jane Mayer. Long-serving chief of the Egyptian Central Intelligence Agency, Omar Suleiman, negotiated directly with top CIA officials on these renditions. Suleiman was described as very bright, very realistic. He was cognizant there was a downside to some of the negative things that the Egyptians engaged in. This is a quote of torture and so on. But he was not squeamish, unquote. And neither is NBC. Hello, welcome to the show. From New Orleans, Louisiana, from the French Quarter in New Orleans, Louisiana, this particular time. I'm Harry Shearer welcoming you to this edition of the show. Ladies and gentlemen, the new F-bomb, foreclosure. Big banks accepted substandard loans to package into securities. Doesn't that make you feel secure? During the buildup to the financial crisis, even though a due diligence service they hired to examine the loans rejected many of them as deficient. This is according to the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission's report this week. The panel study found that Clayton Holdings, a provider of due diligence services for large financial institutions, rejected 28% of the loans in the sample of 900,000 mortgages analyzed as deficient for failing to meet underwriting standards. Yet, nine big banks accepted on average 11% of those loans anyway. In many cases, such loans failed to meet both underwriting standards and guidelines provided by the financial institutions purchasing the loan, according to the commission. Nice people doing nice things. And now, ladies and gentlemen, tales of airport security. This is from Aaron. Dear Harry, I haven't heard your show in a while. I used to listen regularly when I lived in L.A. I live in Providence, Rhode Island now. And still listen to the podcast. Do you still do Tales of Airport Security? Yes, sir. And you're on it. He continues, I flew to Quito, Ecuador last week out of Providence's TF Green Airport. After passing through security without a hitch, I reached into my man purse in search of my phone charger. What I found at the bottom of my bag worried me. A 5-inch pocket knife and a utility knife. I work for a builder, so it isn't unusual for me to have such things in my bag. But I didn't think to check while packing. I thought about going back to security to tell them and to turn them in. But I was worried that it might delay me. So I went to the restroom, wrapped them in toilet tissue, and tossed them in the trash on my way out. I had a couple of connections to make on my way to Quito. The first was LaGuardia. There I had to switch from U.S. Air to American. As you may know, this requires leaving one terminal, entering another, which requires another pass through security. Again, I went through without a hitch. After a brief wait, I caught my connecting flight to Miami. In flight, I opened another pocket in the same bag and discovered that I had my Swiss Army knife, about 4 inches closed. I had managed to pass through TF Green with not two, but three knives in one small bag, and then through LaGuardia with one. I tossed this one the same way when I reached Miami. When I left Quito 10 days later, the security at the airport made me open all of my bags because they saw something suspicious in that same bag on the X-ray. It turned out to be a Phillips screwdriver tip for a drill about 3/4 of an inch long, 1/4 inch in diameter. Don't you feel better now? Thanks, Aaron. Tales of Airport Security, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. News of the digital wonderland, ladies and gentlemen. Radio interference from digital television signals has created a dangerous situation for emergency personnel in Gloucester County, New Jersey. Until the county can pull together the nearly $20 million it will take to permanently resolve the issue, it's taking measures to mitigate the problem by reconfiguring its existing communications equipment to convert from one emergency band to another. But we don't have good radio operability on the new band in this region, says the county's emergency management coordinator. It's not the way we'd like to operate. And it's only a temporary solution because there's simply not enough room on the 450 to 460 frequency to accommodate all emergency communications because they share it with businesses. And it's very possible that the digital TV interference could seep into that band in the near future. Since 2007, emergency personnel in the county have had to contend with digital TV signals dropping into their radio channels, interfering with or cutting off altogether communications between dispatch and emergency response teams. The interference is caused by digital signals broadcast from other East Coast states like North Carolina and Connecticut getting trapped in a duct, viaduct, of cold air being overrun by warm air, a phenomenon known as tropospheric ducting. Digital signals are supposed to be restricted to a 50-mile radius to avoid these kinds of problems, but these air ducts cause them to travel much further, sometimes up to 250 miles away. Eventually, every other county in New Jersey will have to switch to a still new frequency band. The conversion could cost up to $20 million, says the emergency manager of Gloucester County. It's really our only option. It's getting so dangerous, unquote. But it can't be dangerous. It's the digital wonderland. And speaking of dangerous,
clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Safe, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, safe, too safe to meet. Safe, safe.
Our friend the Atom visits us again. Like a glorious, cheery specter that doesn't put a gun in. No, sorry. So this is part of a series of articles from the Seattle Times on the problems at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. And you probably could use a reservation there right about now. This is where we built a lot of our bombs, and it's been a big cleanup job that the Department of Energy has taken on. Multi-billions. You're welcome. But apparently not all is well at Hanford. Imagine dangerous gases building up in a giant drum of nuclear waste. It explodes and spews contamination, threatening workers or the public. It could happen if radioactive material there at Hanford isn't kept stirred. So engineers years ago proposed a solution inside the plant's giant drums. They would put pumps that work like giant turkey basters. Using air and suction, they would slurp up and spit out radioactive sludge to keep it constantly trained. Despite hundreds of millions of tax dollars and nearly a decade of effort, builders haven't proved these pulse jet mixers will work and work safely, according to interviews, audits, internal and external project documents, and emails. It's a case study of Hanford's engineering challenges and helps to explain why the site's waste-to-glass project often seems to be in crisis. Walt Tamosaitis is an engineer and high-level manager with one of Hanford's contractors. He charges that speaking out about this project cost him his career. He has since filed a whistleblower complaint. An investigation is underway. Neither the Department of Energy nor its contractors will comment on his accusations. They maintain they've solved the mixing problem. University scientists and experts with several federal offices aren't convinced, says the Seattle Times. Hanford's treatment plant is supposed to run waste from leaky underground tanks into large drums in a shopping mall-sized building. Hey, kids, let's all hang out there. Their radioactive elements will be separated and turned into glass. And that glass, ladies and gentlemen, is half full. Along the way, when waste sits in the plant's dozens of holding vessels, pulse jet mixers will stir them. Hanford's waste holds up to 1,700 pounds of plutonium-239, scattered among 50 million gallons of other poisons. It's a heavy element and will want to settle at the bottom of these drums. Over time, too many particles could gather and trigger a chain reaction. It did happen in Japan in 1999. Reprocessing plant workers combined too much uranium. Suddenly there was a flash of blue light and an intense surge of radiation. Two workers were vomiting within the hour. One died in 12 weeks, another in 7 months. Particles of plutonium or any other heavy element could also build up and trap and release hydrogen, and that could then explode. Stirring ensures none of these particles accumulates. But jet mixers have never been used on this scale or with such a mix of chemicals and radioactive isotopes. And some of Hanford's holding vessels are installed in black cells, areas expected to be so hot with radioactivity already, that no human or equipment can get in to fix them. That means nothing must break down during decades of operation. Well, we're good at that. The mixers must be strong enough to keep waste from clumping and delicate enough not to spit out any air particles with too much force, which could ruin the pumps or damage the drums. Jet mixers were tested way back in 2000. Already questions emerged. Plant design and construction continued while engineers tried to answer those questions. In the mid-2000s, mixers still had problems. Bechtel started redesigning them, but because of construction had continued, the Government Accountability Office said the redesign and delay drove costs up by $300 million. You get the idea. It's fun. It's a fun project. And Dateline, oh, by the way, another week, another leak at Vermont Yankee. Dateline, Vernon, Vermont, radioactive tritium has been found in still another well at the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant. They may not make electricity reliably, but they sure do churn out leaks with great regularity. This well is near another well where the isotope tritium was found last week. What do you think the spokesman for the plant said? Investigators are trying to determine if it's from a plume from last year, and there's no risk to public health. How many leaks do you think there'd have to be before there'd be a risk to public health? We're going to find out soon. This is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. So, anything in WikiLeaks that we didn't already know? Well, try these. There's a Bush-era cable from 2007 detailing thoughts on Egyptian presidential succession. No one, according to the cable, in Egypt has any certainty about who will succeed Mubarak. Contenders include his son, Omar Suleiman, Suleiman is described as a Mubarak consigliere. Nice people doing nice things. U.S. Embassy assessed that because of his military background, he would have to figure in any succession scenario, possibly as a transitional figure. Suleiman adamantly denies any personal ambitions, but his interest and dedication to national service is obvious. His loyalty to Mubarak seems rock solid. An alleged personal friend of Suleiman's told the U.S. Embassy that Suleiman detests the idea of Mubarak's son succeeding as president, that he's deeply personally hurt by Mubarak, who promised to name him vice president several years ago, but then reneged. See? He's got feelings. He may send people to be tortured, but he's got feelings. The American Embassy in Cairo helped a young dissident attend a U.S.-sponsored summit for activists in New York while working to keep his identity secret from Egyptian state police, reports The Telegraph in London. On his return to Cairo in December 2008, the activist told U.S. diplomats that an alliance of opposition groups had drawn up a plan to overthrow President Mubarak and install a democratic government in 2011. He's already been arrested by Egyptian security in connection with the demonstrations. His identity is being concealed by the newspaper. And, according to the BBC, the British government has admitted that the army and UK civil servants helped market so-called bomb detectors, which did not work, around the world. The move followed a BBC Newsnight investigation showing they could not detect explosives or anything else. Export of the magic wand detectors to Iraq and Afghanistan was banned after that investigation. But Newsnight has learned they're still being sold around the globe. At least four rival manufacturers have sold their own version of these devices, and they're now the subject of a major fraud investigation by the City of London Police. One maker sold thousands of the so-called detectors, which essentially consist of a radio antenna on a hinge attached to a plastic handle to Iraq for $85 million. It's been alleged that hundreds of Iraqis died in explosions in Baghdad after these detectors failed to detect suicide bombers at checkpoints. The boss of the company, ATSC Limited, is currently on bail after being arrested on suspicion of fraud. The profit margins in the sale of the equipment are enormous. The manufacturer of another of the devices, the Alpha 6, has admitted to BBC's Newsnight they make them for £11, that's about $15, and they're sold for £15,000 each to the end user. That's some end user. Just 3 months after the ban on sales to Iraq and Afghanistan, a product called the HEDD-1, a radio antenna on a handle made in Bulgaria, was displayed at a security exhibition at a London conference. The company selling the devices, Unival, claimed that while all the other products, which looked like it were a massive scam, theirs was different. It was marketed by a retired British Army colonel, John Wyatt, who told prospective buyers it had, quote, proved extremely successful in several foreign countries, including in double-blind tests. In reality, the maker of the HEDD-1, Yuri Markov, had been charged here in the United States in 2008 for fraudulently claiming that the previous version of his so-called bomb detector could detect bombs. U.S. Navy had subjected it to a double-blind test and found it, quote, does not work. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Speaking of Iraq and Egypt, so now it seems as though we're seeing the wave of democracy or the push for democracy spreading like wildfire throughout the Middle East. Because of our invasion of Iraq or because of some cables being leaked that revealed corruption in Tunisia. But those cables would never have been released if we didn't topple the statue of the thing with the guy. Anyway, so there was a period Friday when everybody's TV screens that had a TV screen was filled with these remarkable images from Cairo, when everybody was wondering, okay, when are we going to hear something from President Mubarak? And when are we going to hear something from President Obama? In the interim, we had heard this from Vice President Biden.
Should Mubarak be seen as a dictator?
Look, Mubarak has been an ally of ours in a number of things that he's been very responsible on relative to geopolitical interest in the region, the Middle East peace efforts, the actions Egypt has taken relative to normalizing relationship with Israel. I think that it would be, I would not refer to him as a dictator.
Well, that settles that. The president, of course, did come out with a statement eventually. More about that next. Another episode of Clinton Something here on the show.
Clinton Something, the State Department years.
This is bad, hon. This is really bad.
It's being a little premature.
What do you mean?
Well, the cable traffic I'm reading says Mubarak has a good chance of hanging on to power.
I'm talking about the food here in Davos.
The food's bad?
What food are the Swiss famous for?
Well,
the cheese with the holes.
Mm-hmm.
And the holes are the best part.
Well, anyway, it doesn't look as bad as it looked 2 hours ago when I was talking to the White House.
Mm-hmm. They were saying the glass half overturned by violence.
Oh, you know how they are. They never want to be accused of being out of touch like...
Like Bush during Katrina.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So they're watching Al Jazeera and they're freaking out.
Oh, I don't blame them. They got this chick anchor in Doha. So you're telling the White House to cool it?
Among other people who apparently need to.
Oh, no, look, I'm just an appreciator of talent at this point in time.
That doesn't mean you can't tell me about her.
Maybe later. Yeah. Anyway, Toots, I wish I could feel as sanguine about the situation in Egypt. You know, my global initiative has a $2 million thing with Mubarak. If he goes to London, I got to think that... That $2 million is his traveling companion. Then I got a board that wants to know how I signed off on that deal without some kind of clawback provision in the event of a revolution named after a flower or a color.
Well, we've got a 4 o'clock meeting scheduled.
All hands?
All big hands. Mm-hmm. Me, the president, the vice president, me.
Mm-hmm.
The chief wants to decide whether he wants to say something.
About anything?
About Mubarak.
Yeah, he should. About 12 hours ago, he should.
Bill, you know this guy. He's about as impulsive as a 2-ton boulder. A very thoughtful 2-ton boulder, but still.
Well, listen to it. I know the concerns of an ex-president running a billion-dollar humanitarian enterprise don't amount to a hill of beans in this cockeyed world.
But?
No, that was it.
Well, I just think in this whole situation, somebody's got to speak up for democratic principles and human rights.
Mm-hmm. And so?
No, that was it.
All right, look, guys. Mm-hmm. I'm just as happy not to say anything. You know, let President Mubarak deal with it as he will. We pick up the pieces afterward. But Axelrod and a couple other folks here think my silence is louder than any statement I could make, aside from death to Mubarak.
Mr. President,
yeah,
let
Joe.
Me... Let me take the first swing at this, if I might. All due respect to Dave Axelrod, as I understand it, this is his last day in the White House. The rest of us have continuing responsibilities. Now, Mubarak's a good guy. When he lacks in transparency and adherence to the rule of law, he more than makes up for in regional stability, and you can't buy that.
Well, Pakistan sure proves that point.
Yeah.
Could I get a swing at this now?
I'm not just yet. I'm in mid-swing. Mm. So I think, sir, that whatever we say...
Whatever I say.
Right, of course. Mm. Should be very carefully calibrated to not make it look like you're throwing this good man under the bus because, among many other things, I understand his folks keep very good records of the extraordinary rendition people this country has sent to him.
Mm. Could be embarrassing. But that would involve looking backward. We're trying to win the future. Hillary, your shot.
It was baseball, now it's basketball. I'm just going to talk. Mr. President, the Egyptian street is out in front of us now. Yes, there are good and sufficient reasons for us to have been partners with President Mubarak in the past. But that's looking backward, too. Mm. We've already got people in Al Jazeera showing tear gas canisters made in USA.
Crap, I missed that.
If we don't get ahead of this curve, the answer to why do they hate us is going to be, with all due respect, sir, you.
So, we do throw Mubarak under the bus?
Sir, I just think in this whole situation, somebody's got to speak up for democratic principles and human rights.
Mm-hmm. And?
No, you know, that's it.
Okay. Well, we're under the gun here. Mubarak's delaying his TV speech until he knows what we're going to say.
What you're going to say.
Right. So I think I do both the right and the smart thing.
Which is?
I say I'm on the side of the Egyptian people and the Egyptian government.
Yeah, we're the facilitators of reform.
Yes, we can talk to both sides.
We can make it happen. You know what? You know what this is?
Hmm?
This is us winning the future. Okay. We good?
We're good. We're damn good.
Youthful angst and middle-aged power. Together they add up to Clinton something. The State Department years.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'll read the trades for you. From Marketing Week, Coca-Cola Vitamin Water ad, banned. Yes, I'll read it for you. Who else is going to do that? Ryan Seacrest? Coca-Cola has been censured for the second time in 18 months for misleading health claims made about its vitamin water brand. Don't tell the athletes. A poster ad for vitamin water stated, quote, enhanced hydration for the nation above the range of drinks with the words delicious and nutritious below. The British Advertising Standards Authority upheld complaints on the grounds that the claim that the product was nutritious was misleading, and it has advised Coca-Cola that the ad should not appear again in its current form. Rotate it clockwise. The British advertising watchdog said consumers could be misled by the ad into thinking vitamin water was a nutritious drink. But most people would not expect a nutritious drink to have, quote, the equivalent of 4 to 5 teaspoons of added sugar, unquote. In response, Coca-Cola said the product could be described as nutritious because it contained nutritionally meaningful quantities of several nutrients and 100% of the recommended daily allowance of vitamin C. It said these quantities were in line with the dictionary definition of nutritious, which states, quote, containing many of the substances needed for life and growth, and providing substances that people need in order to be healthy, unquote. The same agency banned a campaign for vitamin water in October 2009 after ruling that claims about the health and nutritional value of the drink were likely to mislead consumers. So, the drink may not be habit-forming, but the creation of the advertising sure is. And from another source comes this quote from a Coca-Cola spokesman on the subject. Quote, we have always been completely transparent that the drinks contain 23 grams of sugar in each 500 milliliter bottle. We do not believe this detracts from the vitamin and mineral content. It's not a flaw, it's a feature. An insight granted to you when I read the trades for you, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Think of it.
Nothing breaks, nothing hurts, and nothing aches. We got ourselves one hell of a place in my head. Looking down at the world below, a bunch of wine, fighting schmoes. Well, up here we got none of those in my head.
Thank you.
This is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you? I think you will.
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Yes, we can. The temperatures of North Atlantic Ocean water flowing north into the Arctic Ocean adjacent to Greenland happens to be the warmest water in at least 2,000 years are very likely related to the amplification of global warming in the Arctic, so says a new international study involving the University of Colorado Boulder, led by Robert Spielhagen. The study showed that water from the Fram Strait that runs between Greenland and Svalbard, an archipelago constituting the northernmost part of Norway, has warmed roughly 3.5 degrees in the past century. The Fram Strait water temperatures today are about 2.5 degrees warmer than during the medieval warm period, which heated the North Atlantic from roughly 900 to 1300 and affected the climate in northern Europe and northern North America. The team believes the rapid warming of the Arctic and recent decrease in Arctic sea ice extent are tied to the enhanced heat transfer from the North Atlantic Ocean, says Spielhagen. The total loss of Arctic sea ice extent from 1979 to 2009 was an area larger than the state of Alaska. You can see the sea ice from here, and some scientists there believe the Arctic will become ice-free during the summer within the next several decades. Such a warming of the Atlantic water in the Fram Straits is significantly different from all climate variations in the last 2,000 years, says Spielhagen of the Leibniz Institute of Marine Sciences in Germany. And a long-term retreat in snow and ice cover in the northern hemisphere is weakening the ability of these seasonal cloaks of white to reflect sunlight back into space and cool global climate, according to a study published in the journal Nature. Over the past 30 years, the cooling effect from this so-called cryosphere, essentially areas covered by snow and ice at least part of the year, appears to have weakened at more than twice the pace projected by global climate models. The study represents a first try at calculating from direct measurements the impact of climate change on the northern hemisphere's cryosphere. Of particular interest is a self-reinforcing process or feedback through which warming reduces snow and ice cover. Those reductions expose more an ocean and landscape to sunlight during spring, summer, and fall. After absorbing the sunlight, these exposed features radiate the heat back into the atmosphere. This accelerates the loss of snow and ice already triggered by global warming. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now,
he's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector. He peeks at no stoops. He's an inspector general.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Apropos of the new F-bomb, ladies and gentlemen, a mortgage modification program aimed at saving homeowners from foreclosure has failed because regulators are afraid to rein in or impose penalties on the mortgage servicers whose record, quote, has been nothing short of abysmal. That's from Neil Barofsky, the Special Inspector General for the government's bank bailouts. He bluntly labeled the mortgage program a failure in testimony before a House Oversight Committee. Quote, and I think that if Treasury doesn't respond to some of these things in a quick manner, the call to dismantle the Home Affordable Modification Program, HAMP, as in hamper, is just going to become a louder and louder chorus, and understandably so. The Treasury Department defended its handling of the program this week. I agree that the servicer performance has been abysmal, and that's something we've been trying to fix, said Tim Massad, the Treasury official in charge of bank bailouts. Let me first make it clear this is a voluntary program. Congress didn't give us the tools to impose fines. Blame for HAMP's poor performance rests not with the Treasury Department, but with a mortgage servicing industry that can't distinguish, quotes, between the foreclosures that are inevitable and those that are avoidable, says Kathleen Day, a spokeswoman for the Center for Responsible Lending. There is such a thing? It has a Santa. It's an actual Santa. And a top U.S. oversight office has recommended that the United States halt further funding for a $25 million education academy for senior Iraqi security officials because they discovered that the Iraqi government had never agreed to operate or maintain the facility. It's so win-win, isn't it? The United States has spent more than $13 million on the project. At this point, it is unclear if the government of Iraq will budget for the operations and maintenance of the Iraq International Academy upon completion, says Stuart Bowen, the Special Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction. He's had a fun job. Without such an agreement, he adds, U.S. funds spent on construction are at risk of being wasted, as are the funds planned to equip and furnish the facility. He found that U.S. military training mission, which developed the project, never raised with the Iraqi government its responsibility to operate the facility. And although Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki in 2009 authorized his defense ministry to pay money to move families out of the buildings that were to become the academy, the government never agreed to take over its operation. The United States has paid out $13.4 million to a construction contractor who has developed a campus that includes three classroom buildings, an administrative office building, a dining facility housing for almost 200 people, a state-of-the-art student center with a large auditorium, coffee shop, library, and research center. Bowen's investigators interviewed Iraqi Defense Ministry officials and found, as one official stated, he simply assumed the United States would fund the operations for at least 1 year. In addition, the investigators discovered the U.S. side had never provided Iraqis with estimates on the size and cost of the proposed facility or expenses for maintaining it or the equipment the U.S. would supply. Aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, a roaring success. News of the Inspectors General, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, rounding third base and heading for home, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
The owner of Cafe Hun, who trademarked the word Hun in Baltimore, Denise Whiting, wants Baltimore to know she's sorry. Not sorry she trademarked the town's classic term of endearment, just sorry she spoke about it so clumsily that her adopted hometown came to think of her as greedy, and sorry that nobody seemed to be listening when she made basically the same apology in a letter to the editor in the Baltimore Sun. That's okay, darling. Deadline Port-au-Prince, ousted Haitian dictator Jean-Claude Duvalier apologized to the victims of his 15-year regime and said he'd returned home to work for national reconciliation at a time of crisis. And please send money. I'm here to show my solidarity at this difficult moment, he said in his first full public statement. After which, his press aides beat up some journalists. No, they did not. Come on. Before a crowd of reporters and Jewish leaders in Montgomery, Alabama, Governor Robert Bentley of Alabama apologized for comments that many considered offensive towards non-Christians. Just hours after taking office, Bentley made comments to a group of people at a Memorial Baptist church in downtown Montgomery, in which he said anyone who wasn't a Christian wasn't his brother or sister. I did not mean to offend anyone with my comments there, he said. When he made the comments to the church audience, he assumed he was speaking as a private citizen and not as governor of Alabama. So he's a private bigot, not... Oh, sorry. Dennis Kucinich, congressman, former presidential candidate, has settled a suit against the Capitol Hill cafeteria he filed after he damaged his tooth biting down on an olive pit in a sandwich wrap in 2008. He claimed when he bit into the olive pit full sandwich, a sad run of woes began. He split a tooth down to the bone, which required extensive dental work, and the tooth became infected. Then he suffered a reaction to an antibiotic. Finally, he had an intestinal obstruction that required emergency medical attention. Late this week, the two sides settled for an undisclosed amount, and Kucinich said in a statement, I don't want to make another dental visit for a very long time. The defendants have responded fairly and responsibly. He was apologizing for his distraction of his constituents. Dateline Alberta, Canada. Mayor Stephen Mandel apologized for the city's handling of snow removal and vowed to do better in the future. Gee, I thought Canadian cities knew how to do snow removal. Turner Network Television officials have issued an apology after comedian Tracy Morgan made a lewd remark about former U.S. vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin on live TV. He stunned viewers with his comment about the former Alaskan governor during his appearance on the Inside the NBA broadcast on Thursday when host Charles Barkley asked him, Sarah Palin's good-looking, isn't she? Prompting Morgan to reply, now let me tell you something about Sarah Palin, man. She's good masturbation material, said a spokesman for the network. It's unfortunate Mr. Morgan showed a lack of judgment on our air with his inappropriate comments. And deadline Nice, France, some survivors of the French trains used to deport 76,000 Jews to the death camps during World War II are angry about what was billed as the first public apology to them by France's National Railway Company, SNCF. The believed President Pepy did not take true responsibility for the train company's role in Jewish deportations when he spoke at a ceremony this week in an old train yard near a warehouse from which about 22,000 Jews were sent to their deaths in 1943 and 44. Pepy signed over the land to the mayor, who plans a permanent memorial on the site in a northern suburb of Paris. He says the enterprise was forced and requisitioned as a cog in the Nazi extermination machine. We will never forget it. The railroad has no plans to pay reparations, which enrages certain spokespeople. The ongoing dispute is a microcosm of the complex issue of the extent of France's collaboration with the Nazis and the extent of its resistance. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Well, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, NPR worldwide throughout Europe. You send 440 cable system in Japan, around the world, through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ and the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want at harryshear.com and kcrw.com, available through stitcher.com for your smartphone, available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And be just like Omar Suleiman being queasy, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. And thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The show is now on Twitter at The Harry Shearer. Join the 23,500 followers, won't you? Don't be a leader. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans.